from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, here's today's forecast. Late night and early morning, low clouds and fog of war clearing by mid-2006. I am in another new studio. The Le Chaux Dôme is, I guess, as mobile as everything else these days. It's an effects-driven show. I don't even know if this broadcast is being heard anywhere, let alone where I'm doing it. So this could be just one for the aliens. As you know, listen to all radio broadcasts just to make sure they're being mentioned enough. And it's wartime. How about this war, huh? How about that Miss Elke Summer? No, that was another war. Long time ago. There will be so little music on this broadcast that the people who've always said, play less music, will be writing in now to say, play more music, would you? Because it just doesn't seem like a musical kind of a day, ladies and gentlemen, or night, depending on where you're hearing. You're not hearing it. I'm talking to myself. Who am I kidding? This is the most preemptible broadcast in the history of radio. Nonetheless, in a hopefully non-hysterical manner, the effort of this broadcast over the next hour will be to sift through some stuff that you may not have heard or read, both on and off topic A, and to provide you with a little entertainment as well, because you're not listening, so you might as well be entertained. We start with our text for today from the speech of President George W., the radio address of President George W. Bush on Saturday, towards the end of the broadcast, his peroration, as they would say in the speech classes. Our nation entered this conflict reluctantly, yet with a clear and firm purpose. That's the sort of thing that gets sort of passed off by journalists as boilerplate rhetoric, and they don't even bother a word we learned during the Clinton days, to parse it, to ask, for example, did our nation really enter this conflict reluctantly? Weren't there policy papers written by people high in the current administration long before they took office advocating just this war? How reluctant can it be when the people who are now in our government have been advocating this since 1996 or 92? Or 1887. I don't know what the exact date is, but you know what I'm saying, ladies and gentlemen. Our nation entered this conflict reluctantly. All right, well, if you can prove that to me, then we're miles ahead of where I think we are at the moment. General Tommy Franks. Now, this drove me crazy. This briefing by General Tommy Franks at CENTCOM headquarters in Doha, Qatar. I'll give you a nickel for every different pronunciation of the name of that country I've heard in the major media since about mid-October. Anyway, he was at one of the few questions he was asked on this subject. Most of the questions were about, resistance. Is there enough resistance? Are you surprised at the resistance? Where were the Iraqis that were supposed to be kissing our troops as they walked in? How come we went right past Basra? Those kind of questions. There was a couple questions, though, nitpickers insisted on asking whether there's been any evidence of weapons of mass destruction found yet, seeing as how that was the reason for the conflict. And I tried like heck, ladies and gentlemen. I heard it on the BBC a couple of times, and by the time I got home, it was off the BBC. I tried like heck to find it on the internet for you. The tape is roaming around somewhere, but not here. But so I do have the quote. One would expect that weapons of mass destruction would perhaps be found in certain parts of the country, General Frank said. And that is work that lies in front of us rather than work that we have already accomplished. So in answer to the what might be question A, since this was the ostensible reason for the conflict, have we found any weapons of mass destruction, any evidence of weapons of mass destruction? General Tommy Franks, one more time, one would expect... Listen, just count the number of weaselings. One would expect that weapons of mass destruction would perhaps be found in certain parts of the country, and that is work that lies in front of us rather than work that we've already accomplished. What's missing from that quote, and what I was trying to find from the tape, in that same answer, he talked about intelligence, some of which was speculative, and some of which might not be. More weaseling. The point of all this, ladies and gentlemen, is at some juncture, there will be pressure. The need to tug the forelock in the direction of world opinion, so-called, to say, see? Now, given the fact that, according to the United Nations weapons inspectors, trust them if you like or not, the information the United States gave them regarding Iraqi attempts to purchase nuclear materials from an African country. This was discussed on this broadcast a couple weeks ago. That material was forged, not by the United States, but by whoever we got it from. Where will we be getting the information that proves that Iraq did, in fact, have weapons of mass destruction after it's all over? That's the gentlest way of putting that question. Ladies and gentlemen, enough questions. Here's some of the other news. Some of the biggest rallies this month have endorsed President Bush's strategy against Saddam Hussein. The common thread linking many of them is Clear Channel Worldwide, the nation's largest owner of radio stations. In a move that has raised eyebrows in some legal and journalistic circles, Clear Channel radio stations in Atlanta, Cleveland, San Antonio, Cincinnati, and other cities have sponsored rallies attended by up to 20,000 people. The events have served as a loud rebuttal to the more numerous but generally smaller anti-war rallies. The sponsorship of large rallies by Clear Channel stations is unique among major media companies, which, as you know, usually do their editorializing more subtly. San Antonio-based broadcaster owns more than 1,200 stations in 50 states and the District of Columbia. "I think this is pretty extraordinary," said former FCC Commissioner Glenn Robinson. "I can't say this violates any of a broadcaster's obligations, but it sounds like borderline manufacturing of the news." A spokeswoman for Clear Channel said the rallies, called Rally for America, are the idea of a Philadelphia talk show host whose program is syndicated by Clear Channel. A weekend rally in Atlanta drew an estimated 20,000 people, with some carrying signs reading "God Bless the USA," other signs condemning France and the group the Dixie Chicks, one of whose members recently criticized President Bush. "They're not intended to be pro-military. It's more of a thank you to the troops. They're just patriotic rallies," said Clear Channel spokeswoman Lisa Dollinger. Rallies sponsored by Clear Channel radio stations were also scheduled for Sacramento, Charleston, and Richmond, Virginia. Jane Kirtley, a professor of media ethics and law at the University of Minnesota, said the company's support of the Bush administration's policy toward Iraq makes it hard to escape the concern that this may in part be motivated by issues that Clear Channel has before the FCC and Congress. Spokeswoman for Clear Channel denies there's a connection between the rallies and the company's pending regulatory matters. For you fans of unintentional irony, C-SPAN is outraged that the City Club of Cleveland banned broadcast media from covering this past week's speech by U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. "Especially galling," says C-SPAN, "is the fact that Scalia was going to the club to collect its Citadel of Free Speech Award." I know. You'd think he'd know. The ban on broadcast media was demanded by Scalia. "It begs disbelief." "And seems to be in conflict with the award itself," said C-SPAN Vice President and Executive Producer Terry Murphy. "How free is speech if there are limits to its distribution?" Scalia made the same demand on a university where he spoke the night before. Reporters and newspaper photographers attended the speech in the school's gymnasium. Shortly after Scalia began speaking, a protester was escorted away. In answer to a student's question, Scalia said it was a wonderful feeling to have led the Supreme Court's rejection of a recount of the Florida vote. So, again, Scalia accepting the Free Speech Award, banning television cameras. And radio microphones, too, ladies and gentlemen. for those of you who are wondering what else the media are doing, because, you know, you can't just keep your mind totally on the war. That would be such tunnel vision, don't you know? So there is other media news this week. Thankfully, it comes from our friends at Fox. Monica Lewinsky, the former presidential you-know-what, who alternately seeks and avoids celebrity, has signed on to host Fox's next reality series, Mr. Personality. You'd think they'd have signed Clinton. But I guess CBS got to him first. The show gets the coveted Joe Millionaire Monday time slot starting April 21st. In Mr. Personality, a young, beautiful single woman will court several... Is this going to be on during the war, you think? Yeah, it's Fox. A young, beautiful single woman will court several eligible men who must rely strictly on their personalities to captivate her. That's because each man will have some sort of mask or hood on through the dating process. But she won't think he's rich, right? I guess. A year ago, Lewinsky said she would do anything to have her anonymity back. In this week's news release, she said, "Since Fox is the network that has had the greatest success with the reality TV genre, I was very excited when they approached me to host the show. It sounds like good fun." She should know. The network described Lewinsky as a graduate of Lewis and Clark College with a Bachelor of Science degree in psychology, adding that for the past few years, she's been designing an exclusive collection of handbags and accessories. The network notes she was raised in Los Angeles, lives in New York, and is considering a future career in law. Ladies and gentlemen, who knew? Sometimes you have to be signed to a reality series before the whole truth comes out. This month, Fox has been scouring the country for people to participate in Mr. Personality. Oh, me, pick me. Looking for men between the ages of 24 and 40, and women aged 25 to 35, who are single, which the network explains on its website means not married. You know, Fox doesn't assume all that much about their audience, do they? No. No, ladies and gentlemen, they do not. We continue. Hello from the edge of America. Welcome to the show.
A high-flying comedy gets grounded. And TV has war plans, too.
It's a special edition of Extra Access tonight for late March of 2003.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo.
It sounded like the movie hit of the summer. A hip urban comedy about a group of aliens that come to Earth to protect America's jetliners. But after three attempted release dates, Attitude Pictures and their distributors have pulled the plug on Sky Martians, which was going to be music star Danny Kaye's passport to movie stardom.
It was some funny shit, because I look like something from the Star Wars bar meets Frankenstein by way of Soul Train, you understand? And there's this fight scene on the plane where this foreign guy keeps trying to clock me with his booby-trapped sneaker while we're going through severe turbulence, you know what I'm saying? And I did my own choreography for that, so yeah, that definitely was some retarded shit in that picture.
For Andy Cohen of Attitude Pictures, putting Sky Martians back on the shelf was no easy choice.
We thought we had a franchise here. I mean, you know, Sky Martians 2, Foreign Guys in Space, that was already in development. We had focus grouped this picture since it was just a concept and all the way through to the idea stage. The audience never told us that there was anything that scared them or anything like that. Otherwise, you know, I'd have greenlit Nancy, the movie. We've had the rights to that for years.
Test screenings had audiences booing and walking out all at once. Even street guy Danny Kaye was worried.
So my peeps are asking me, "Dog, what you think of doing a comedy about hijacking planes and shit?" And I say, "You know, but we're Martians, you know, because that still cracks me up. But they just stare at me like I order a Cosmopolitan or something. So that tells my radar, boom, baby, get under the screen, you understand?"
The team still hopes Sky Martians can fly one day, But Danny Kaye is filling the time before his summer tour, creating and starring in a reality game show pilot called Make Me Sick.
If it's wartime, this must be Tuesday. And television programmers are adjusting at a pace that must be stimulating shock and awe in the competition. The Motion Picture Academy decided that the first victim of this war was the red carpet arrival ceremony, leaving Oscar pre-show hostess Joan Rivers dishing her heart out.
I mean, it's a gray carpet. I mean, what are you supposed to do with that? That's for the dignity. I mean, yeah, if they wanted dignity, they should have told Courtney Love to stay home. Okay, she's not really at the Oscars this year. But, I mean, what are we supposed to say as these people arrive? Ah, can you believe that gray suit? Oh, my God, those lapels are notched. I mean, you know, it's all right for me. I have a career. But poor Melissa.
Co-executive producer Jamie Mularkin is making last-minute changes in NBC's hit reality show, Fear Factor.
All the insect-related stunts are out for the duration of the hostilities. We've been banking less disgusting challenges for just a situation like this. This week, the contestants all have to eat sweetbreads. You know, it's still like yick, but it's a classier kind of yick.
On the news side of the networks, the competition heats up in wartime. We talked to CNN's Aaron Brown.
In terms of the people over there, everybody's, you know, sent their A team. So it is really a contest about in the chair next to the anchor who's got the best former generals. And I just happen to think our former generals are top of the line.
Not surprisingly, Dan Rather has a different take on the war, the network war.
Tell you this, CBS News as a gold standard type television news operation has, we've got two mandates that we're crippled critter serious about. Do the best possible electronic journalism about this conflict, real pedal to the metal journalism. And two, make rock solid sure for certain that we don't put the Howard Stern prank caller on the air anymore.
For the networks, there's one thing worth fighting for, and that's viewers.
That's it for now, but Extra Access Tonight comes rolling back next time with the results of our EAT poll.
We asked you what sitcom Saddam Hussein should join as a recurring character, and the results should make Raymond wonder if he wants to be loved by everybody. Till then, I'm Pat Mungo.
And I'm Mike DeVere.
So long from Culver City.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of the key policymakers in the Bush administration and in the run-up to this war is Richard Perle, chairman of the Defense Policy Board and advisory panel to the Pentagon. He was one of the founders of the think tank Project for the New American Century that wrote the policy papers calling for a war in Iraq. Way back when. And you may wonder, in the wake of the failure of the United Nations to support the eventual war on Iraq, how Richard Perle feels about the state of the international community. So we'll take a little time to share with you Richard Perle in the Guardian newspaper of London this past Friday. This now is Richard Perle, ladies and gentlemen. And by the way, well known as a gourmand. So he ain't eating burgers when he's writing this. Quoting, Saddam Hussein's reign of terror is about to end. He will go quickly, but not alone. In a parting irony, he will take the UN down with him. Well, not the whole UN. The good works part will survive, the low-risk peacekeeping bureaucracies will survive, the chatterbox on the Hudson will continue to bleat, What Will Die is the fantasy of the UN as the foundation of a new world order. As we sift the debris, it will be important to preserve, the better to understand, the intellectual wreckage of the liberal conceit of safety through international law administered by international institutions. As free Iraqis document the quarter-century nightmare of Saddam's rule, let us not forget who held that the moral authority of the international community was enshrined in a plea for more time for inspectors, and who marched against regime change. A few days ago, Shirley Williams, who's a British Member of Parliament, this is still Pearl, argued on television against a coalition of the willing using force to liberate Iraq. Decent, thoughtful, and high-minded, she must surely have been moved into opposition by an argument so convincing that it overpowered the obvious moral case for removing Saddam's regime. For Lady Williams and many others, the thumb on the scale of judgment about this war is the idea that only the UN Security Council can legitimize the use of force. It matters not if the troops are used only to enforce the UN's own demands. A willing coalition of liberal democracies isn't good enough. If any institution or coalition other than the UN Security Council uses force, anarchy rather than international law would prevail. This, says Pearl, is a dangerously wrong idea that leads inexorably to handing great moral and even existential political military decisions to the likes of Syria, Cameroon, Angola, Russia, China, and France. When challenged with the argument that if a policy is right with the approbation of the Security Council, how can it be wrong just because China or Russia or France or a gaggle of minor dictatorships withhold their assent, she fell back on the primacy of order versus anarchy. This new century now challenges the hopes for a new world order in new ways. We will not defeat or even contain fanatical terror unless we can carry the war to the territories from which it is launched. This will sometimes require that we use force against states that harbor terrorists, as we did in Afghanistan. The most dangerous of these states are those that also possess weapons of mass destruction. Iraq is one, but there are others. Whatever hope there is that they can be persuaded to withdraw support or sanctuary from terrorists rests on the certainty and effectiveness with which they are confronted. The chronic failure of the Security Council to enforce its own resolutions is unmistakable. It is simply not up to the task. We are left with coalitions of the willing. Far from disparaging them as a threat to a new world order, we should recognize that they are, by default, the best hope for that order and the true alternative to the anarchy of the abject failure of the UN. Richard Pearl, ladies and gentlemen. More about Richard Pearl? Sure. It's right here. Stand by, won't you? I had it here. Yes, here it is. One British company linked to the American defense consultant Richard Pearl and dealing with secret intelligence is among the few British commercial organizations that stand to profit from the Iraq War and its accompanying worldwide terrorist alert. The Cambridge-based Autonomy Corporation, with Pearl's help, is selling secretly advanced computer eavesdropping systems to intelligence agencies around the world. Its software simultaneously monitors hundreds of thousands of intercepted emails and phone conversations. It turns patterns of conversation into beams of light of varying thickness on a screen, revealing anomalies that might be code phrases. Pearl, along with the most high-profile proponents of war with Iraq, is a director of Autonomy, with an option on 75,000 of the company's shares. He advises the company on market opportunities. And in that op-ed that Richard Pearl wrote, he disparaged countries like Cameroon, Syria, France, China, Russia, autocracies and limp-wristed whatevers, and hailed the idea of a coalition of the willing of liberal democracies. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the roll call. There are some nations that have asked the State Department not to make their names public yet. They're the part of the coalition of the willing but bashful. But here, up to the minute, is the complete list of those countries who wish to be known as part of the coalition of the willing. Afghanistan, Albania, Australia, Azerbaijan, Bulgaria, Colombia, the Czech Republic, Denmark, El Salvador, Eritrea, Estonia, Ethiopia, Georgia, Hungary, Italy, Iceland, Japan, South Korea, Latvia, Lithuania, Macedonia, the Netherlands, Nicaragua, the Philippines, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, Spain, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and last on our list of the coalition of the willing liberal democracies, Uzbekistan. Check it out. So liberal. So liberal. Tom Daschle has a summer, has a dasha there. So that's Richard Pearl and his friends, ladies and gentlemen. But there's more. The Bush administration's audacious plan to rebuild Iraq envisions a sweeping overhaul of Iraqi society within a year of a war's end, according to the Wall Street Journal. The Bush plan, detailed in more than 100 pages of confidential contract documents, would sideline United Nations agencies. Gee, I wonder why. I wonder whose idea that would be. And other multilateral organizations that have long directed reconstruction efforts in places such as Afghanistan and Kosovo. The plan would also leave big non-governmental organizations largely in the lurch. More than $1.5 billion in Iraq work being offered to private U.S. companies under the plan. Just $50 million is so far earmarked for a small number of groups such as CARE and Save the Children. Oh, what about those U.N. inspectors? You know, they left. They're gone. But still, they have parting words. As they fled Iraq, some of them were angry at the Bush administration for cutting short their work, bad-mouthing their efforts, and making false claims about evidence of weapons of mass destruction. Some inspectors were scandalized at the way President Bush and Secretary of State Colin Powell have, quote, politicized, unquote, the inspection process, according to a source close to the inspectors. None of the nuclear-related intelligence trumpeted by the administration held up to scrutiny, inspectors said. From suspect aluminum tubes to aerial photographs to documents revealed to be forgeries that claimed to link Iraq to uranium from Niger, inspectors say they chased U.S. leads that went nowhere and wasted valuable time in their efforts to determine the extent of Saddam Hussein's arsenal of weapons banned after the Gulf War. Some of the inspectors leave with a deep suspicion of U.S. motives. Some believe, for example, that recent flights of U.S. U-2 spy planes were intended to help the military draw up target lists, not to aid the inspectors. Here's somebody we haven't heard from anywhere else, I don't think. The United States and Britain are unlikely to find legal support for abandoning a multilateral approach to Iraq, according to New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark. Hey, that's a liberal democracy. Where are they? The U.S. and Britain are, of course, doing this war. Ms. Clark said U.S. and British would stretch back through a string of U.N. resolutions to construct a legal edifice for what is happening. I think they will fail to convince most international lawyers, she said. I think the lawyers will argue about this till kingdom come. Self-defense would need to be involved for war to be legal under the U.N. charter, Ms. Clark said. The U.N.? Where's she at? this is the winner in the sweepstakes to determine the highest possible estimate for the cost of all this. Dateline Washington. This is from a European press service. The White House has refrained from making a clear statement about the budget of the war. Non-governmental organizations have given a variety of prognoses. CNN reported today, that's last week, that the cost of war, occupation, and reconstruction could range anywhere between $9 billion and $1.92 trillion. $1.92 trillion, ladies and gentlemen. And, apropos of our last sortie, that saluted in the op-ed by Richard Pearl, a U.S. general has accused the West of failing to do enough to rebuild Afghanistan. The chief of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, Lieutenant General Dan McNeil, not Don McNeil, Dan McNeil, said he was frustrated that the West had not made a more bold step to rebuild Afghanistan, adding that this could be an important lesson for Iraq. Hey, either way, babe, the U.S. search for al-Qaeda and the Taliban would have been easier, he said, had the aid flowed faster. Whoa, talk about burying the lead. The U.S. search for al-Qaeda and the Taliban would have been easier had our promised post-war aid to Afghanistan flowed more rapidly, according to the U.S. chief of forces in Afghanistan. His remarks, according to the Independent of London, echo the worries of many in Afghanistan's capital city of Kabul. Fear abounds that the war in Iraq and its aftermath will mean that international support for Afghanistan falls away. Frustration has been steadily growing on the ground over the slow pace of reconstruction, which in many cases has scarcely begun. General McNeil said foreign aid had helped avert a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, but some countries had not fulfilled subsequent aid promises. He said what is needed now is an overstep by the international community. Boy, he's not on the same page with Dick Pearl. International community, where are you at, babe? Towards reconstruction, clearly there's a lesson to be learned for those who have responsibility for other conflicts and post-conflict situations, he said. Gently. According to a report by CARE, the per capita spending of aid money in Afghanistan last year was well under half that of post-conflict Bosnia, Kosovo, Rwanda, and East Timor. Ladies and gentlemen. Oh, but now, look. Enough of all this. This is Le Show. It's time for the apologies of the week. Ain't it?
We're so sorry.
Yes, and many, 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 many apologies this week. Starting with the BBC. The British network broadcast a minute and 37 seconds of presidential primping to hundreds of millions of viewers in 200 countries around the world before Bush's formal address announcing the launch of military operations against Iraq. The BBC's White House producer, Mark Orchard, profusely and repeatedly apologized to irked White House staffers for airing video of an unauthorized portion of the pool feed. CBS News Washington Bureau Chief Janet Leisner, whose news crew was responsible for pool coverage of the speech, also apologized to the White House, explaining that a technician accidentally flipped a switch that fed the images of a not-ready-for-air Bush, his eyes darting to and fro as a female stylist sprayed, combed, and patted down his hair. A BBC spokeswoman said her network promptly realized the video was not for broadcast, but they couldn't pull away because of technical difficulties. The commercial network ITV in Britain also aired the feed. The facts are that it was an unauthorized use of footage and video, a senior White House official told the Washington Post. Both the BBC and CBS have apologized, and it would be understandable if this were the only time this has happened. I'm not suggesting that it was intentional, but this kind of thing has happened more than once. Henceforth, the official said, the White House, not the networks, will throw the switches that make the pool feeds available. There have been too many incidents, the official said. We have to make sure we're comfortable with the situation. Not only the BBC apologized, ABC apologized, but for something else. The network jumped into the war story Wednesday night, 11 minutes behind its broadcast competitor, but jumped out of the story temporarily at 11.01 p.m. when Peter Jennings signed off, to the surprise of ABC stations across the Eastern, Central, and Mountain time zones, whose screens went black because they'd been told ABC News would continue its coverage well into the night. ABC continued to air The Bachelor, Where Are They Now?, while ABC and CBS were covering the bombing. Then ABC didn't have Peter Jennings on hand. He was at a dinner. ABC stations had received messages from ABC's network alert system informing them not to bother with their late-evening newscasts because ABC was going to continue its war coverage. In Miami, ABC viewers saw 4 minutes of promos while the station scrambled. The ABC station in Hartford, Connecticut, broadcast 9 minutes of promos. Several stations had blank screens. Said ABC News president, or ABC Television Network president, Alex Walla, "We felt we'd covered this story in Iraq to that point, and that we should allow for your late local news broadcasts. We were not aware that there had been alert system communications sent to your station saying there would not be a local news opportunity last night. This left many of you in an untenable position. We deeply regret that we let you down last night, and we're committed to earning back your trust." That's their ABC's apology to its affiliates. The Montreal Canadiens have apologized because many of their fans booed the Star-Spangled Banner before Thursday's game against the Islanders. They were booing, apparently, to protest the United States' war against Iraq. The fans' behavior incensed many Islanders, who beat the Canadiens 6-3. Well, they got them up for the game. Some members of the team said the booing had inspired, them. 5 members of the Islanders' roster and coach Peter Laviolette were born in the United States. "It is our firm belief that this kind of behavior has no place in the context of professional sports," Pierre Bouvin, the president of the Canadiens, said in a statement. The crowd booed the Star-Spangled Banner to a lesser degree before a game Tuesday night against the New Jersey Devils. "We're concerned about these isolated incidents of disrespect for spectator conduct when the anthem is being played," said a National Hockey League spokeswoman. "We're working aggressively with that club to remedy the situation." The league said fans in other Canadian cities have not booed the United States anthem. So there. And now, ladies and gentlemen, because it's been too long, let me read the trades for you. Will you? Can I? Won't you? Just take time out from all the heavy stuff. This from Advertising Age, the Bible of the advertising business. On the subject of TiVo, is it a threat to advertisers? I'll read it for you. Stay right there. Or preempt me as you wish. Dateline Cincinnati. I always like a story that starts off that way. Recent internal research by Procter & Gamble, makers of Tide, Cheer, and all those soaps and stuff, indicates that consumers who fast-forward through ads with digital personal recorders such as TiVo still recall those ads at roughly the same rates as people who see them at normal speed. This surprising research has led at least some Procter & Gamble marketing executives to conclude that TiVo may not pose the threat to TV advertising that many predict. A P&G spokeswoman would say only, "We have nothing we can share publicly on TiVo." Even if recall scores aren't affected by fast-forwarding through the ads, however, other copy testing measures such as persuasion, liking, and branding power are likely to be affected, says Mark Scharr, who formerly ran market research for Procter & Gamble. He said he was not aware of the TiVo research before he left the company last year to found a totally different company. But he said recall scores generally tend to be low anyway, That's probably not an unusual finding based on the way people recall things, Mr. Schar said. People hardly recall anything. So you're dealing with low numbers anyway, and differences with low numbers take a lot to be significant. So I could see, statistically, you could make that case. People are more likely, he said, to recall commercials for products they know and like. That's bad news for marketers of smaller brands trying to break through the clutter, but helps bigger, more established ones. A factor that could help Procter & Gamble products, whether they're seen live or on high-speed TiVo fast-forwarding. If it appeals to you, Schar said, if you play it fast or slow, it could click. But Schar said he also doubts consumers who fast-forward through ads at the highest of three speeds available on TiVo could possibly have meaningful recall of them. Procter & Gamble has in the past shared other TiVo research that found only about a third of TiVo users actually fast-forward through the ads, though it becomes more frequent the longer people use the technology. Always surprising, always delightful, ladies and gentlemen, when I read the trades for you. It's so very much of a copyrighted feature.
Reason enough, ladies and gentlemen, to not preempt this broadcast today is we have, Chris, is that ready? What do I push to put it on the air? I know I should have read the manual. I'm just saying, what do I, okay. We have on our newsmaker line right now from, it says Baghdad. All right, Baghdad, Iraq. From our new, or somewhere in or near there, a gentleman who was asked to be identified only as Shab Shab.
Hello.
And who claims to be, and we've checked this out, we called him back at his number, one of Saddam Hussein's lookalikes. Shab Shab, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you very much. It's good to talk to you.
I'm pleased to talk to you, sir.
Thank you.
As I understand it, you are one of Saddam Hussein's lookalikes.
That's
correct.
Is
that
yes,
actually your job or something that you do as a hobby or what?
Well, you have to understand, in Iraq, there are no hobbies. It's a desert. There's no fly fishing, no golf.
Yeah.
Bowling is unknown here.
I would have...
So, yes, it's something I do.
Mm-hmm.
It is not my full-time moneymaker.
What?
For that, yeah. I have an electronics store.
Mm.
We can get you into Dolby 5.1 for... What is in these conditions a very attractive price point?
Uh-huh. So you specialize in high end?
No, all frequencies.
No, I mean in terms of high end of the line of audio equipment.
Yes, yes. Well, there's no point in selling the cheap Korean crap here. No one could afford it.
All right. So, Shab is Shab Shab your first name, or is it Mr. Shab Shab? How do I
think if you just say we're all better off.
Okay, better off is good.
Yes.
Shab Shab, how did you come... Who noticed that you are... First of all, how much do you look like Saddam Hussein? I mean, do you have the mole or not?
Yes, I have the birthmark, what you'd call the mole.
The mole.
Saddam has had it removed. It's considering having it removed. We were in talks. They broke down in the face of the current circumstances.
Right.
So right now I don't work because I have the birthmark and he does not.
Wow. I'd invest in the surgery and figure I'd make it up on the bookings.
No,
but how actually busy were you when you were working in Saddam Hussein's lookalike? I mean, how many appearances would you make a week?
Well, it depends what season it was in.
What do you mean, like spring?
It's football season. I appear at home games of teams away from a presidential box.
Uh-huh.
Many of those.
I see. So and by football, you mean soccer.
In the interval,
yes.
The mascot would come and shoot balloons at me comically, and the crowd laughs, and it's good fun for all.
Yeah, in Iraq, just because you mentioned it, do the mascots, what are they, in bird costumes?
No.
Chicken suits?
No. In Iraq, of course, no freedom to choose what your mascot will be representing. It. Everyone is in Saddam Hussein suit. So I'm a Saddam Hussein lookalike being comically victimized by mascot dressed as Saddam Hussein.
Wow, so that's potentially confusing if the mascot was enough of a... was a good enough likeness. What is he, Terry Cloth?
Yeah, he's Terry Cloth. No, he's very cartoonish. I'm very lifelike. It's no confusion.
I see.
Just good fun.
Okay, when we saw that tape the other night of what purported to be Saddam Hussein on the air, do you ever do television appearances?
Yes, I have done several television appearances as Saddam Hussein in the past year. Most recently, opening of a Can't Believe It yogurt store in Basra.
In Basra.
That was on local channel, all the local channels. It's you know, monstrous here.
Yeah, well, four times on TV in the last year, you're ahead of me.
Well,
I guess what I'm trying to gently nudge around to as a subject here, Shab Shab, is when we saw that tape the other night, was that Saddam Hussein? Was that you? Do you know who that was?
I'm not really at liberty to comment on that. Let me just say it wasn't me.
Okay.
Because... as I indicated before, I have the birthmark.
Okay. So, do you know who that was? Do you know if Saddam Hussein is dead or alive? Do they call you and tell you to clear your schedule because there may be an emergency television appearance? Is that the sort of thing that would happen?
I'll be working at this store. I'll have a customer.
All right.
I'll be demonstrating a Bose system.
A Bose.
Or Kef.
Kef.
Very popular here.
British.
And I'll get a call on my cell phone, and it will be from the palace. And it will be, can you get into the Saddam suit by a certain time?
Yes.
And I'll look at my watch, and I'll say yes.
Yeah, I guess you would. And so they don't tell you what the appearance is for, whether it's international television or just an opening of a...
No, in my case, I pretty much know, because I'm not to be self-effacing or anything, but I'm number 8 or 9 on the list. I know this.
Ah.
So for international television, it would be...
what, number one?
I can't use the name, but number one, number two, number three.
Yeah.
I get the appearances he would never make, even if he's okay, which I'm sure he is.
I see. So
Or would be.
Okay, so...
you know, things are different.
So why, Shab, if I could, why did you call in today if there was no chance that this tape that we've seen all over the world was, in fact, you?
Which
would have been the news... value of
the... I understand the thrust.
Okay.
Just, you know, I think in coming weeks, months, years, more demand perhaps for Saddam lookalike outside Iraq. Many agents listen to your broadcast.
I'm kind of sorry to have to inform you that probably is another intelligence failure. As far as I know, no agents listen to this broad. And if they did, I don't know how they would...
Well, let me just say, for really compelling Saddam Hussein lookalike, Shab Shab, and they can get in touch with you.
Well, all right.
And if you are in the market for a great tube preamp...
Well, no,
which is such a warm sound.
Warm sound. No, I know.
Market here has just dried up for vintage equipment.
No, I can imagine. Well, Shab.
Yeah.
Saddam Hussein impersonator and stereo dealer, thank you so much for calling us on our Newsmaker line today. I'm sure you have plenty to do or plenty to stand by to do.
I'm in the book.
If you know what I mean.
Yes.
So best of luck to you, sir.
Thank
you for handing us our very first wartime exclusive here on Le Show.
Ir vakna horoje.
The charges. This is, we can't have, ladies and gentlemen, some people really do have a way of keeping their eye on the ball. Arguing that federal officials are demonstrating more concern for cartoon characters than for Chicago residents. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley denounced the decision to leave his city off the list of those with restricted airspace as the Homeland Security Department moved to protect New York, Washington, and the Disney amusement parks. Oh, there's a call coming in. I'm going to ignore it. Federal officials defended the decision, saying they believed New York and Washington were at greater risk, in part because both cities had already been attacked by hijackers. Not persuaded, Daley exploded with outrage. Why should Washington have it and New York, and now I'm hearing Mickey and Minnie have it, the mayor said at a news conference this week. Now think of that. Mickey and Minnie have it. I mean, I can't believe that. They get it first before we get it. So if we had a Mickey and Minnie, I guess, who lived in Chicago, we could have one. Maybe you do. One federal aviation official said Disney was included in the restrictions because of a months-long lobbying campaign waged by its corporate owner. Disney has been assisted by several members of Congress who slipped a clause into a huge federal spending bill passed this year that requires flight restrictions over the Disney amusement parks. They were announced the same day as flight restrictions over New York and Washington, but the curbs over the Disney parks were imposed independent of Operation Liberty Shield, says the spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security. The anti-terrorism plan continues to allow flights by private aircraft over the two East Coast cities. Similar restrictions are now in effect at Disneyland in Anaheim and Walt Disney World in Orlando. The FAA ordered the restrictions for New York and Washington on the basis of specific threat assessments. That determination, spokesman said, was not made for Chicago. I say, hey, you want that protection? Get yourself a Mickey. You know, ladies and gentlemen, if I were fixing to have a war, I would love to kind of bait my potential opponent into destroying a lot of his missiles in a vain attempt to comply with a disarmament demand that basically was there to get my potential enemy to destroy a bunch of his missiles before he was attacked, don't you know? But hey, we don't need to do that. We can win this thing with one arm tied behind anybody's back. Still, it's good strategic thinking. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show for whoever in the universe happened to be able to hear it. This program returns next week at the same time, God knows where, maybe on this station, maybe on others, maybe on stations that forgot to record it this week. They'll remember to record it next week. Who knows? On NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, across North America, on Sirius Satellite Radio, if that exists. I haven't had an email from any of those listeners yet. And up and down the east coast of North America, booming on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. And, if all else fails, on your computer, whenever you want it, at two different locations, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com. And it would be just like the war being over by then, if you'd join me next week, would you already? Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to go embed myself in bed. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. See you next week from Baghdad. Funding for this program came from nowhere and went the same place.